Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. The New Mexico primary is June 7th, and officials are gearing up for a big turnout in this presidential election year. We've seen rallies by all the campaigns as we head into this day, including an eruption of protests at a rally held by presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton has a big delegate lead over Bernie Sanders, but Sanders supporters are not giving up. Additionally, the legislature is in play as Republicans look to maintain their hold on the House and possibly take the Senate, and Democrats look to keep their control of the Senate and take back the House. What are the key races you're following in your area? What do you think of the presidential candidates, and who are you voting for? Join our conversation by calling 277-5866 or email callinshow@kunm.org. Joining me today is Gabriel Sanchez. He's a professor of political science at the University of New Mexico, and he's with Latino Decisions, a survey focused on the Latino population. Hi, Gabe. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
So New Mexico doesn't have a huge number of delegates compared to other primaries like California, which is the same day. But we have a significant voting block of Hispanics and Latinos. Does that make the state more significant for these candidates?
I think it does, particularly in an election like this, where Latino or Hispanic voters nationwide are projected to be a pretty big deal and an important electorate across many swing states. So I think there's a lot more attention on New Mexico to see how the Hispanic population will do here, because it gives us a little bit of a microcosm of what might be playing out across the country.
What impact is immigration having on this campaign among Hispanic and Latino voters?
Well, immigration in our polling has been consistently number one or number two among Hispanic voters in terms of the most important issue that they're going to vote on, either there with jobs and economy, so either number one or number two. You thought maybe in this election cycle immigration would take a little bit of a back seat, but immediately in the primaries, some of the Republican candidates made immigration front and center with some of their stances on the issue. So it's really, again, come to the forefront of not only the minds of Latino or Hispanic voters, but a lot of voters across the country.
No, we are kind of an unusual state in terms of our Hispanic voting bloc. We have people who are recent immigrants from Mexico. We also have people who have been here 500 years. And sometimes immigration hasn't been a huge issue. But is that shifting because it's become such a hot button issue? Is this creating any kind of unity among that voting bloc?
It actually has. I mean, back in 2006, it used to be the case that you would literally think about immigration politics not really being critical in New Mexico, largely because we just have a much smaller share of foreign-born population than any of our neighbor states. A third of California's, half of Arizona's, much smaller even than Colorado's. But I think that shifted largely because a lot of the Hispanic population perceives that these laws being passed in several states, think Arizona, isn't just about immigration, but is framed as anti-Latino in nature. And I think that's galvanized the Hispanic population around that issue and moved the population overall to the left.
So are more, do you think more Hispanic and Latinos are registering to vote in this election because of some of that rhetoric from the Trump campaign and from others?
Well, we've seen a slight uptick in voter registration, and a lot of that is, you know, is that about Hispanics and immigration and Donald Trump dynamics, you know, increasing that. There's also a lot of swell around Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. So I think those candidates bring some folks out that have never voted before and are now interested in the election, which is a good thing, I think, overall for democracy.
I also have with me today political science professor Lana Atkison with the Center for Voting Elections and Democracy at the University of New Mexico. Welcome, Lana.
Ah, thank you.
Lana, there's still a fierce competition going on among supporters of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. That's likely going to bring out more voters in the Democratic primary. Where do we stand in terms of delegates for each candidate and superdelegates? And maybe give us a quick, what is a superdelegate?
What is a superdelegate? A superdelegate is a very special person. That's why they're super. And they are party leaders, governors, big city mayors, former executive leaders of the party who've given this, you know, opportunity to ride to the convention free. Mm-hmm. And they've been around since the mid-80s. The Democratic Party thought we needed to, you know, end these contests quicker. But it seems that, you know, in the last few elections, certainly 2008 and in 2016, what we've seen for the Democratic Party is that these superdelegates, you know, have been contentious when there's a competitive contest. And so now we're not talking about the superdelegates. We're really talking about the pledge delegates. Mm-hmm. So that's why everyone always says, oh, yeah, how many pledge delegates does she have? And, you know, Hillary Clinton is still substantially in the lead. She has several 100 more delegates, mm-hmm. not quite 300. And
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this will bring out traffic for the Democratic primary, voters for the Democratic primary. But we have a presumptive Republican nominee in Donald Trump. Does that affect the outcome or the turnout?
Yes.
For the Republican primary?
It does. So, you know, I've actually run these models and you can see that turnout is affected by the campaign ending and that turnout really drops off. But there are lots of reasons to turn out. And actually, one of the things that we find in our data is that when you have other kinds of contests going on, that those are incentives to come out despite the fact that the race is over. And you still get to express your preferences if you don't like Donald Trump. And, you know, if one of the other candidates on the ballot, there are other presidential nominees on the ballot in the Republican Party. If you didn't like him and didn't want to support him, you could choose to support someone else and demonstrate that in the contest. And, you know, if there were enough votes for the other candidates, they could theoretically gain some delegates as well. So it's even though the race is effectively over, your vote is still counted and it's still meaningful.
Well, we just saw this introduction of a potential independent candidate today, David French from the National Review. Does that mean someone can go write him in?
No.
If they go, okay, that doesn't...
You could, but it wouldn't be counted.
Okay.
It's just if you wrote in Mickey Mouse, it doesn't count either. but you have to be approved as a write-in candidate for it to be counted.
Okay. We saw Donald Trump go after Susana Martinez's record when he was here. She used to be a popular potential vice presidential candidate. Then we saw a bunch of Republicans coming to her defense. How does that play out in terms of the primary and the election here?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the fact is there were 8,000 Republicans who went to watch Donald Trump and they presumably voted for Martinez. And I think she's walking a very fine line. She's the, you know, leader of the Republican Governors Association. She's a leader of the Republican Party. And, you know, I think that there's a responsibility on her part and on Donald Trump's part to, you know, find a place where they can meet, you know, if they want to, you know, she wants to do something with the House in the fall. You know, she's going to worry about coattails. She needs to be thinking about what her long-term strategy is. And a long-term strategy isn't what played out between her and Donald Trump during that rally.
This is the KUNM call-in show, and I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about the upcoming primary this Tuesday, June 7th. Are you planning to vote, or have you early voted? Are you registered as an independent and prevented from voting in the primaries, and how does that feel? Are the candidates talking about the issues you think are most important to us here in New Mexico? Join our conversation by calling 277-5866 or email callinshow@kunm.org. We have one caller, Andres, from Rio Arriba County, and he wants to tell us why he's voting for Bernie Sanders.
Yes, well, I had initially leaned towards Don, but, you know, in the mudslinging and everything coming out, I'm really getting more leaning towards Sanders, and, you know, because of the more things that come out, the more that turn me off on what they really say and what they really do. And you know, I think Sanders, you know, he's on the sideline. And if my predictions work out, I think he's going to be the one to take it. Now, you know, the best one wins. And I'm leaning towards Sanders right now. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Andres. I'm curious. So I believe he said he was supporting Donald Trump, but he's going to support Bernie Sanders now. On the surface, that looks like polar opposites, Lana.
Well, I think it's important for voters to understand that they can only vote in the party that they're registered in. So if you're an independent, you actually can't participate in the primary in New Mexico. And if you are a Democrat, you have to choose between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Just so callers understand, it's not an open ballot.
Gabe, is that as different as one would think to go between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think the context might have been that he was a Sanders supporter all along.
Okay.
That's what I heard. But you typically don't see folks jump back and forth party-wise within party across candidates. And in fact, a lot of the late action that we're seeing in polling is moving towards Bernie Sanders here in New Mexico. Now, all polls have Clinton winning pretty handily here in New Mexico. That's why she hasn't invested her own time and energy coming through the state. But Sanders did make a couple of different stops here. He's invested in trying to pull out New Mexico. So the polling, you know, it's tough to say because a lot of the folks like the caller might not have ever voted before, or not typical voters that we usually pick up in our polls. So although it's projected to be a landslide, all polls have Clinton winning by at least 20%. I think it's going to be quite a bit tighter than that, but I still think Clinton will pull it out in the end.
I was going to ask you that. There was a poll this week by BWD Global, that shows Hillary Clinton with a huge advantage among Hispanic and Latino voters over Bernie Sanders here. But you're saying we should take polls right now with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you're actually seeing, for the first time in a while, a lot of pollsters who are very reputable getting things wrong across other primaries. And a lot of that is the action from both Trump and Sanders, where you've got a lot of first-time voters, not just young people, but first-time voters that don't typically show up in polls. And remember, in that poll, I believe it had 19% undecided. That's a pretty big chunk of people that are still kind of trying to figure it out as we get to the home stretch here.
A Fox Latino, also speaking of polls, did a poll recently. They found, going back to our previous conversation about immigration, they actually found the primary issue for Latino and Hispanic voters was with the economy, and they were actually more optimistic about their future than other voters. If that's true, how does that play out?
I had a good conversation with those folks about that poll, I think, last week, talking a little bit about the methodology. You know, all polls are really based on who you're talking to, whether it's on the phone or online. I think economy and jobs for Hispanics across the country and here in New Mexico are definitely, if not number one, number two issue, largely because folks forget that, you know, the economic recession hit Latinos harder than any other population. And here in New Mexico, we're still struggling with the recovery. So it's not surprising that economy and jobs are definitely on the mind of Hispanic voters. And Hispanics overall across a number of issues tend to be much more optimistic. So I think those things fit conventional wisdom and are somewhat intuitive. Question is, of the candidates, who's actually projected to be the best on economic development and job growth? And that's what gives Donald Trump that lane that he perceives he might be able to play with the Hispanic population. Hmm. He's really used that as an issue, not really courting Latinos specifically, but saying, look, Latinos, if you care about jobs and economy, I'm the person who knows how to do that because I've done it over my career as a businessman.
Although he's getting a lot more scrutiny about some of those things right now.
Lately, yeah, and he, you know, it's as though he doesn't want to court the Latino vote. You know, the judge on his Trump University, he came out this week and said he's biased because he's Mexican. He's born in Mexico, and reality is, the guy's actually born in Indiana. So it's another one of these issues, you know, not quite accurate. Yeah. But those kind of things, I think, play to the narrative that for the average, I think, Latino out there in the United States, they say, hey, I might want to actually support Donald Trump, but he's making it difficult to do so.
We have another caller from Albuquerque. Sarah wants to talk about candidates and early voters. Sarah, you're on the line?
Yes. You know, it's just that I early voted 2 weeks ago, you know, after the third day when they opened up that one polling place. And I only knew like six people. And then there was 25 other people that I never knew who they were. Even though they were like running for district attorney and very important things, and so, you know, I just hear all this advertisement and flyers in my mail like starting like 3 days ago, but it does not help me any or people that like to vote early. So I was told that this is a very frustrating situation for most people that vote early, you know. Because we don't know the candidates, and they only come out like 10 days before the election day, you know. So it's a very frustrating process. Why is it that they just assume that what's the percentage, like 70% of the people do just vote on election day, and then what about the rest of us that we don't know how to vote because we don't know any of the candidates, you know? Because so that's kind of like my frustration. You know, they just come out too late.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for calling. Thanks. And Lana, it's an interesting point. We see this huge push towards early voting. Is there a disconnect with the other sort of mechanisms to get information out about candidates?
Well, I mean, sort of in that we're in an institution that's different than a general election, right? So we're in a presidential, not just presidential, but also state nominating primary campaign. And so that is a different intra-party contest. And so, you know, the kinds of information that you find in a inter-party contest is not as easily available, and it's not like the candidates are out there working the streets in the same kind of way. Hardly any voters turn out relative to a general election. You know, primary turnout is much, much smaller. And so a lot, and then the candidates are all very similar because they're all intra-party candidates. So they're very similar. So things tend to derive based on sort of character and who you know and incumbency and these kinds of things. And often there are no competitive contests right. in many of the mm-hmm. races. So, you know, it's a product of sort of the institution and the fact that these people, a lot of these candidates, you know, they don't have a lot of resources to put in very early. And so they're waiting very late also because more voters vote late on primary than in the – whereas in the general election, more mm-hmm. people vote early or absentee.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, but during the primary, more people vote on primary day.
Well, this is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we will be right back after this break.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting public radio KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated civil rights, criminal defense, wrongful death, security clearance, and Indian and family law cases throughout New Mexico. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support provided by Power Ford on Montaño, new and pre-owned vehicles, service center, and quick lane tire and preventive maintenance centers on Montaño west of I-25 Northeast, Bridge Street in the South Valley, and at PowerFordNM.com.
Why do some children succeed while others fail? Paul Tough, author of the bestseller How Children Succeed, says success is not based on IQ or smarts, but on character skills such as grit and determination. On the next New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas, please join host Stephen Spitz as he sits down with Paul Tough to explore how to help children succeed. This Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about the upcoming New Mexico primary on June 7th with Professor Lana Atkinson of the Center for Voting Elections and Democracy at the University of New Mexico and Gabriel Sanchez, who teaches political science at UNM and is also with Latino Decisions, a survey focused on the Latino population. And we were just talking about early voters. We also have another caller, Bo, in Albuquerque, wants to talk about any efforts to open the primaries. Bo, you're on the line.
Hi, I had to jump the fence this year. I changed my registration from Republican to Democrat to vote for Bernie Sanders. And so I have two points. I'd like you guys to discuss what you do know about efforts to change our primary system to be an open primary so people don't have to change parties and they can vote for who they care for in the primaries. And the other question I always have is, what kind of influence do you believe that the media's discussion of political strategies instead of issues has on the electorate? Thank you.
Okay. Lana, we did have an effort in the last year to have open primaries.
Yeah. And so that lawsuit failed. And, you know, that would take legislative action. I think there are legislators who are interested in that, particularly on the Democratic side. Who would like to see that open up. So I think there are potential for legislative opportunities there. We'll just have to see. I think continuing mm-hmm. to want that and providing pressure, you know, to encourage people to participate makes a lot of sense.
Gabe, the other point about the media following the horse race rather than the issues.
Yeah, I mean, on the first point, I've actually done quite a bit of research lately on opening up the primary process. And in some jurisdictions, you have as many as 40% of eligible voters who are declined to state or independent. So it is a serious issue. I mean, you've got a lot of folks who, like the caller, feel they have to pick one party or another to participate, and a lot of other folks who feel they're disenfranchised. On the media issue, you know, there's a lot of debate about how much of an impact the media has. The long story short of it is political science literature has largely found that the media can impact what voters are thinking about, but not necessarily change their mind about the underlying policy issues. So like the caller states, you know, the focus on the horse race and bar chart showing who's out in front, that's what the media generally focuses on. So you have to actually do a little bit of your own homework to see what the underlying policy views of the candidates are. And as Professor Atkinson's already noted, in the primary, that's tough because essentially most folks are saying the same thing, because they're obviously within the same parties. That makes it a little bit more difficult to determine, you know, do I vote for candidate A or candidate B?
We have another caller, Pete from Santa Fe, about the parties and their bases. Pete, you're on the line.
Good morning. I wanted to explore the social dynamics that go behind the formation of a party. a party is a collection of people that have a common ideal, a common goal. Parties are run by insiders. They're the people who are vested in the outcome. This year, we've seen our traditional parties, the Republican and the Democratic Party, they seem to be out of favor with the populace. And we see possibly a party coming up out of whatever the ashes of Trumpism will be. The Tea Party is an example of one that's on the rise. We have to have insiders because the world is run by those who show up. But what is the? I would like some comments on how do we get people enlisted in their party again to where they say, yes, I am a member of that party with pride because they stand for what I represent. Thank you.
That's a big question. Mm-hmm. Either of you want to take that. Gabe, I mean, is it a matter of we're becoming, the Democrats have traditionally been kind of a big tent party, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The Republicans have focused, am I right, more on their base in the last few years. What do you think we can, is there a big change happening now within the party structures?
Well, overall, a couple points to make is that, you know, there's a lot of question about how powerful and important are parties in the U.S. political system these days. You're seeing a lot of more of the population moving towards independent and mm-hmm. essentially saying party's not driving my vote choice the same way it has historically done. And in the Republican Party, you know, issue this is how powerful are those insiders? I mean, they've done everything possible to try to prevent Trump from being the nominee, and they couldn't do that. So, you know, the question about how powerful are insiders, that remains to be seen. And keep in mind, in the Republican Party, most of us would say there's a number of parties, right? A number of factions within the party that are essentially nominating different candidates. Marco Rubio perceived to be the person within the establishment side of it. You've got Cruz representing the Tea Party dynamic. Obviously, those folks didn't make it all the way through. And you've got Trump, who's really creating a groundswell of a lot of new potential Republican Party voters long term. And that's the way he's framing it, that, look, we should be a broad tent similar to the Democratic Party and allow all these different voices to be represented within the party structure.
And, you know, Lana, to the Democratic side, Cokie Roberts had a column recently with her husband basically saying they criticized Sanders for staying in. He said, you're hurting the party. You're hurting Hillary Clinton's chances.
You know, that's probably not the case. So, mm-hmm. I mean, research pretty much indicates that although there's a lot of hostility and anger at the end of the campaign, that, you know, Sanders voters are most likely to stay in the party and vote for Hillary Clinton when they come down to it. Because, you know, what do you got at the end? You've got, if you're a Sanders supporter and you get to the general election, he's not an option anymore. Your option is Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And the fact is that if you're a Sanders supporter, that ideologically, Hillary Clinton is a lot closer to you in terms of policy interests than Donald Trump would be. So historically, what we've seen is that, you know, sure, there's all this fighting and there's some anger, and you see a lot of that during the nomination campaign, but that resolves itself over the summer and as the general election kicks in and people are reminded, why am I a Democrat? Why am I Republican? Right? And they're reminded and they're brought back to the parties. So one thing we can really see is, for example, is like polls. Polls in January don't do a very good job of predicting polls in November. But actually, polls starting about now are starting to tighten up and starting to be much stronger predictors. And you know, you can see that in sort of the polling. You know, all these people, I mean, no one was supporting Donald Trump 2 months ago, but now it's a tight trial heat, right? And so we can already see this sort of coming back to the parties in the trial heat polls.
Somebody had a question on email. How are polls done in New Mexico? I mean, they're all done very differently, but are they randomized calling? Talk briefly about what a good poll is supposed to look like.
I think Lana and I could probably spend 2 hours talking about that subject.
Both
of us are polling experts. Long story short of it is the methodology is typically to try to catch a random selection. In most cases, if it's a voting-related poll of eligible voters, at least likely voters, more the case, and you're trying to capture them through as wide a net as possible. So these days, in addition to phones, which include cell phones, most polls will also include a web sample to try to capture, especially young people, which are very difficult to catch on the phone these days. You want to catch them through email. And I guess the key point points are on polling, and, you know, the sample has to be sound, so you make sure that you're giving folks a random opportunity to participate. And the question wording has a big deal to do with the quality of a poll. So the thing to kind of pay attention to is who's funding the poll. You know, do they have a vested interest in the outcome of the results? And taking a pretty close look at, you see those plus or minus percentage points usually tied to a poll. Obviously, the smaller the better, because in a tight race, let's say it's projected to be a 47% to 53%. If the margin of error is 7%, it's not really telling you a whole lot about who's going to be the winner of the election if it's a horse race dynamic poll.
Okay. This is the KUNM call-in show. We're talking about the upcoming primary on June 7th. The last day for early voting is this Saturday. All 112 legislative seats are on the ballot this year as well, but control of the legislature will be decided by a handful of key races. What are the local races you're watching, and what issues are important to you this election year? Call now, 277-5866. Toll free 866-899-5866 or email callinshow at KUNM.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUNM News. We're joined right now by Steve Terrell by phone from Santa Fe, New Mexican. Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Steve, this is a big year for the legislature. 2 years ago, the GOP took control of the House for the first time in 60 years. What are the key races this year as Democrats try to take that back and try to hold on to the Senate?
Well, there are quite a few. The one that's going to be watched in November, the big one, will be down in Boleyn, Valencia County, Michael Sanchez's district. Michael Sanchez is the Senate Majority Leader, and the governor is out once again to try to get him.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try to flip that seat. So it's that's going to be a key one.
We also have the Democrats lost a seat last year in District 39, which stretches east of Santa Fe down near Ruidoso, because former Senator Phil Griego resigned. The governor appointed a Republican, Ted Barella. Now there are four Democrats vying to be his opponent. Who seems to be the front runner right now?
One.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to tell. You know, there's been no polling, so anything say is speculative. As far as the campaign funds, which is a measure, you know, it's one of those horse race things you're talking about. But candidates who are able to fund themselves basically tend to do better. Not they don't want, the one with the most money always doesn't always win. But the two that have to watch here in the primary are Liz Stefanik, a current Santa Fe County Commissioner, and Huey Lay, who is a former San Miguel County Commissioner. San Miguel County voters, they constitute about half of the district. And Santa Fe constitutes the other half. There's other four counties that not quite as much. It stretches all the way down to Lincoln County.
I know. I saw the map. It's huge.
Yeah, it's an enormous district. But the bulk of the voters are in Santa Fe and San Miguel.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those two have raised the most money. The other candidates there are Mike Anaya, former Santa Fe County Commissioner, and Ambrose Castellano, who's been on various school boards in San Miguel County. And
is it likely that seat could go back to a Democrat?
Yeah, most people think that's the most endangered Republican seat. Ted Barella, he's been in the Senate now for over a year. But he's a Republican, and it's an overwhelmingly Democratic seat, probably more conservative than most Democrat seats. But he's probably got the biggest challenge of all the Republican incumbents.
And right now, just to remind people, the House Republicans hold a 4-seat advantage in the House. The Democrats have a 6-seat advantage in the Senate. Another challenge, longtime Senator John Sapien of Corrales is facing a challenger in the primary, and the Republican opponent in that race, Diego Espinoza, has raised more than almost any other candidate, I think I read in one of your columns. So is Sapien vulnerable?
That's going to be a tough one for Sapien. He was in the same position 4 years ago. He had a primary opponent and a general election opponent, and he won by a squeaker in the general election, and that's when the Republicans are hoping to pick up. Most people think it'll be easier for nothing's easy, but it's going to be slightly easier for Democrats to flip the House than it is for Republicans to flip the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
senator is just a little more entrenched. If three seats in the House would give the Democrats control, and three seats in the Senate would make a tie, which with Lieutenant Governor being a Republican, John Sanchez basically gives it to the Republicans.
We also see Sandra Jeff, a former Democratic lawmaker, challenging Senator Benny Shendo, another Democrat, for his seat.
Yeah, that's another one to watch. Sandra Jeff, a lot of people think she's like a Trojan Republican because she's backed the Republican Party so much. She's had trouble getting on the last time she was kicked off the primary ballot when she was running for her old House seat because she didn't get enough petition signatures. And this time she was originally kicked off the ballot in the Senate race because she owed fines for not filing campaign finance reports. And it's interesting that in both cases her lawyers were well-known Republicans. Zach Cook, who's a representative from down in Lincoln County, he was her lawyer in this last case, and Pat Rogers, a longtime Republican lawyer, was her lawyer before. So,
you bring up Pat Rogers. There was a recent battle for the state Republican Party leadership among Pat Rogers and Harvey Yates. Rogers had the backing of Governor Martinez, and Yates has been critical of her advisor, Jay McCleskey. Should we read
and
anything?
And the governor herself, And Harvey won that one.
So what does that signify about the state Republican Party right now?
Well, there's a real split there. And the governor has a lot of enemies who are, of course, Democrats, but also a lot of Republican enemies, more than you'd think. And it was kind of I think that was basically an anti-McCleskey vote.
I hear you saying, nodding, Gabe, or I hear you saying, what does that say to you in terms of the Republican Party in New Mexico and also the dynamics we saw with Martinez and Trump last week?
Yeah, I mean, some of this is consistent with what we've seen in the past. Most second-term New Mexico governors start to have a difficult time governing their second term. Governor Richardson had a lot of folks within his own party towards the tail end doing similar things. So I think some of that is just normal. But I think what you're seeing play out, and a lot of people are speculating that Republican Party dynamic sends a signal that the governor might not have the same level of leverage that she's had over people within her own party, and there's questions about what that'll mean in terms of some of the key votes that she might be pushing for. So I think that's the speculation. You know, her issues with Donald Trump are also reflective, I think, of the dynamics within the Republican Party, where I think Governor Martinez represents the establishment, head of the Republican Governors Association. You know, she carries a lot of sway, and I think Donald Trump really needs her as a spokesperson for him because he addresses the two biggest issues he has electorally, women voters and Hispanic voters. His favorability among those two populations is not good and is not projected to be very well in terms of vote choice for those two groups, and she has the demographic ability to speak to both of those points. So it was somewhat surprising that not only did Donald Trump on her home turf have some very critical things to say, but he hasn't backed off of that in his post comments after leaving New Mexico.
I want to take a caller right now. We have Nick in Albuquerque. He said he switched to the GOP so he could vote against Trump. Nick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because of all the rhetoric of Donald Trump, I decided to vote Republican in the primary in New Mexico because I wanted to vote against him more than for someone. I wanted my vote to count against him.
But now, Lana, what does that mean now that he's the presumptive nominee if you want to vote against Trump
in
the primary?
It's effectively mute, but yeah, okay. I would still like to vote for Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. Or one of the others that they have already filed. And by the time the primaries get to New Mexico, our votes pretty much are, other than in close races, our votes are not counted.
And what, so you previously were a Democrat, Nick?
Yes, I'm a Democrat. I'll stand with the Democratic Party. And this election is just, it's gotten so out of hand that I just wanted to make sure if I had a vote that it would go against Donald Trump.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Nick. I appreciate it. Steve, you were you covered the recent rallies and campaign rallies here, I think. What was your impression coming away from those in terms of who's got the juice?
I didn't get to cover Trump because Bill Clinton was speaking up in SNL the same day. We got other reporters covering Trump, and that was a lot more exciting than the Clinton rally up in Espanola, I have to say. Mine was like a lady sewing circle compared to the riots going on with Donald Trump and the things he was saying about the governor. That was that turned out to be the one to watch there. Yeah, it's going to be hard for the governor. I think Governor Martinez will eventually get around to saying, yes, I backed the nominee. Maybe I heard that a lot at the Republican convention a couple of weeks ago. All sorts of people saying, yes, we must work for the nominee without mentioning the nominee's name. And I think she'll probably give a pro forma unenthusiastic endorsement of Trump eventually, but this has made it even harder for her to do that. I don't think you'll see her going out of state campaigning for him. I don't think you're going to see her being a big spokesman for Trump at all.
This is the KUNM call-in show. Megan Kamrick, we're talking about the primary. It's coming up June 7th. And what are your thoughts about the election year? Will you vote? Are you feeling discouraged about the process? Are the candidates addressing the issues you want to hear about? Call now, 277-5866, or email callinshow@kunm.org. One more thing, Steve, before we let you go. You spoke to former Governor Gary Johnson this week. He's leading the Libertarian Party ticket. He seemed pretty confident he's going to have some kind of breakthrough.
Well, he's going to do a lot better than he did 4 years ago. I'm certainly not predicting victory at all. And even in New Mexico, he'll do better in New Mexico than in most places because people know him here. And a lot of people still like him here. I think he has the chance to attract a lot of dissatisfied Bernie Sanders supporters. He told me that he took that online test, istandwith.com. It tells you which candidate you most agree on after answering like 60 questions about it.
Gary Johnson took that?
Gary Johnson took that. And of course, his number one was Gary Johnson. He completely agrees with himself. But number two, he said, was Bernie Sanders. He said he agreed with Bernie Sanders on like 73% of the issues. So he has a chance. A lot of Bernie Sanders' appeal is about economic issues, and that's where he parts ways with Johnson. You know, Bernie's for legalizing marijuana, and so is Johnson, of course. But on economic issues, a lot of Sanders supporters, even those not wanting to vote Democrat, might be a bridge too far. But I think he could pick up a lot of Bernie supporters, and I think in a lot of other states he could be a Ralph Nader type factor, and maybe hurt Trump in that way.
Lana, what's your impression, Gabe, about the potential for a third party candidate gaining traction this year when there's so much dissatisfaction?
You know, I like the romance, but I think it's unlikely that, you know, the Libertarian Party's been around a long time and we've seen tough elections come and go and they don't seem to get a lot from that. Mm-hmm. And so the historical record doesn't say that there's a lot of opportunity there. The differences on social issues between Bernie and Gary Johnson, as Steve said, are absolutely going to be very close, but they're absolutely so far on economic issues that it's hard to imagine Sanders voters choosing a Libertarian candidate unless they just don't want to vote for a major party candidate, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine an ideological mm-hmm. attraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, former Governor Johnson's success largely hinges on whether or not he can do well enough on the polls to get on the debate stages. And that's clearly what he's aiming for. If that happens and that's a long shot, then, you know, it gets interesting. I think the other piece to it is, sure, he might be able to capture some of those Sanders supporters, but I think probably more likely some of the Trump supporters who are just as dissatisfied with government, looking for another option. And on economic issues, small government, limited role of government, I think that's probably more of a prospect. Only likely going to matter in key battleground states where it's going to be so neck and neck that a small margin like that moving in Johnson's direction would actually matter.
This is the KUNM call-in show, and we will be right back.
It isn't every day we get a new or newer vehicle. Some of us hang on until they've got 200, maybe 300,000 miles on them. Nothing wrong with that. But when it's time to get the next one, how great to send it off to continue to serve not just you and your family, but the entire community by funding KUNM. Give us a call and we'll send out a tow truck, handle the sale, then send you a tax receipt and a KUNM membership. What a great ending. Call 888-KUNM-CAR.
25 years ago, New York Times star reporter Jeffrey Schmaltz found himself in the middle of one of the biggest stories of his time. He had AIDS.
I feel an obligation to write what just about no other reporter in America can cover in quite the same way. This is the place where I must come to terms with AIDS.
I'm Rachel Maddow. Tune in for Dying Words, the AIDS reporting of Jeffrey Schmaltz.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about the New Mexico primary coming up on June 7th. Saturday is the last day for early voting. We have a caller right now from Pecos, Diane. She wants to ask about the economy and the GOP. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question?
Okay. I have worked in the state government here and am retired now, but I see that 20,000 more people leave the state a year than come in. I see in my community businesses shut down that have been there for decades, people out of work, very depressed. And I'm curious if Susana Martinez, then, as the governor and a Republican of the state, who I think has failed to bring New Mexico along in the recovery after the recession, will the Republican Party suffer for the depressed economic situation in New Mexico?
Okay, thank you, Diane. Gabe, do you want to take that on?
There's no doubt that New Mexico's economy is struggling. I mean, we're at the very back of the pack in terms of recovery from the recession, job growth. Across the board, there's very little sunshine to talk about in terms of our economic stance. How much of that is going to impact the governor? Remember, she's not running for another term, so a lot of that is just speculative. She still remains pretty popular, still has approval ratings over 50%. They're dipping a bit, but she still has, you know, some support. And when we think about probably, in my view, the biggest issue that's going to long-term improve New Mexico's economy, that's early childhood development and that's the rainy day fund. There's enough blame to go around on both the Republican and Democratic side for that issue not actually making it any further. So I think, you know, how much of an impact is going to have on Republicans? I think beyond the governor and think about the legislative races and whether or not that's going to cause some of the shift. But I think on a number of the key economic issues, it's not just the Republicans that have to take some responsibility for that. I think overall we have to look at both parties for that.
One thing is money has been a big conversation topic in this campaign. Bernie Sanders has brought it up often. And we have political action committees proliferating here in New Mexico and across the country. Well, we're joined now by Sandra Fish. She's a reporter with New Mexico In Depth. She's been trying to follow the money in this election season. Sandra, are you there?
Good morning, Megan.
We've seen a trend across the country in the last few years of more money actually going into state and local races. Is that happening here in New Mexico as well?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is because there's actually action at the state and local level. Legislators and county commissioners actually do things, unlike Congress. And you're seeing, you know, for example, on either side, Devon Corporation, an oil and gas company like from Oklahoma, they see state lawmakers, I think, as a way to protect oil and gas production. On the other hand, you see environmental groups like Conservation Voters New Mexico who look at lawmakers or the public regulation commissioners as a way to get away from certain things such as coal development. So Devon has donated more than $150,000 to Republican lawmakers and PACs this cycle. And Conservation Voters is really active in the Public Regulation Commission District 1 seat, where they're airing ads against incumbent Karen Montoya. She's facing a rematch from 2012 with Cynthia Hall. And the primary election in that race is all there is because there's no Republican. So you see these interest groups, they've got interests, and they're going to be played out at the state level, not at the national level necessarily.
You wrote recently, you mentioned a mailer. You wrote about a loophole in our state campaign finance laws having to do with those mailers. I've gotten two or three for the PRC race this week alone. What does that mean for voters, this loophole that you wrote about?
You know, that's an interesting thing. You don't see this happen very often. We're accustomed to getting these mailers that say, paid for by XYZ campaign. But Senate District 39 candidate Hugh Lay in that race that Steve mentioned with four Democrats challenging each other, he wrote a couple of long letters to voters, and it had nothing on it about being paid for by his campaign. And when I called him, he said, well, there's an attorney general's opinion that overturns that disclosure law. So, like he suggested, I called the Secretary of State's office. They sent me the AG's opinion. It's from 1997. Written by Tom Udall, you might have heard of him, U.S. Senator now. And some would argue that this ruling takes a really broad view of a narrow Supreme Court decision. But it hasn't been challenged in court because the Secretary of State's office hasn't tried to enforce the law. They just tell candidates, follow the disclosure law. So technically, we could see more of this out there of getting mailers from people that don't even disclose who paid for it, and that would be a real problem. Now, I have to say, Hugh Lay did start adding the disclosure to his mailers after I called him. So, you know, And most people do that, but I think, you know, there's the real possibility of that. And, you know, I want to plug New Mexico in depth here. Speaking of mailers, we're trying to collect such information at our Follow the Message website. So if you could go to ftm.nmindepth.com, you'll find a place where you can upload flyers and things like that. And right now, today, you can also get information on where primary candidates for legislature stand on issues like transparency, infrastructure spending, and even legalizing marijuana.
I will put that link up on the Call-In Show post. We have a number of article links right now about the national and local races. And I want to go to a caller real quick. Just to go back to our Gary Johnson conversation. As we talk about a very disruptive year, and you touched on this, Sandra, that there's so much dissatisfaction, that's why more money is going to local races. But it's also giving Gary Johnson more visibility. And Cal from Los Alamos had a question about the Johnson campaign. Are you there, Cal?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for answering. My question is this. If there is enough dissatisfaction, say, among Bernie supporters, assuming that Secretary Clinton gets the Democratic nomination, and enough dissatisfaction with conservative small government Republicans over Trump, and if Gary Johnson gets enough electoral votes, you know, by chance, to deny either candidate electoral majority, that will throw the election essentially into the House of Representatives for the first time since, I think, the early 1800s. Do any of the panelists have any thoughts as to where that may go?
Lana Atkinson?
Well, you know, the voting in the House is each state gets one vote. So we just need to, if it's a tie, they don't get to vote. So if there's only two members of the House and one's a Democrat and one's a Republican, they're going to vote differently. Certainly Republicans and Democrats aren't going to vote for Johnson, a Libertarian. So I would say you just have to sum up. You just have to look at what those states look like. I mean, right now we have a Republican House, so I'd say that would give the give it to Trump.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That it's very interesting to think through that, the likelihood of that occurring. I wouldn't bet my house on it.
We also have another caller, Judith from Albuquerque. She wants to talk about Bernie Sanders, who wants reforms from both parties. Judith, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Are you coming through?
Yes. What was your question?
Okay. Well, I just had some comments. I have worked with Bernie Sanders. I've followed his career since he ran for mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And a couple things about him. I think he kind of shoots himself in the foot. Like, he keeps referring to, you know, that he's a democratic socialist, and people hear the word socialist and they shut down on him. But he's actually, you know, pretty savvy about business and getting legislation through in D.C. So he was behind the revitalization of downtown Burlington and also the waterfront on Lake Champlain. I attended his rally here in town. And the crowd snaked around for blocks and blocks. The staff of the convention center said it was the longest line they'd ever seen. I also worked the convention, an event at the convention center that morning that Trump held the rally that evening. And I think everybody was horrified by the rioting that happened. But the more I started thinking about it and reading what I could about it, I don't believe the rioters were our people, were local people at all. I think they were chipped in and financed by someone else. I wish they could follow the money back to see who that was. I've heard it was George Soros. I've heard that they ran ads hiring people to attend the protests, but I don't think our local people were involved with the really violent.
Okay. Thank you, Judith. I appreciate it. We also have another question from Edward, going back to our money question from Santa Fe. You're asking about outside money, Edward, in one of the races, I think probably the Bernalillo County Commissioner's race.
Thanks for taking the call. Good morning. Just curious about folks' thoughts on organizations such as Santa Lena investing heavily into the county commissioner's race. You know, you have these outside entities that definitely have a vested interest, in this case, in land and water and what they're trying to promote and the amount of money that they've infused with little accountability into the county commissioner race here locally.
Sandra, I know you talked about some of that's one of those political action committees with something like New Mexicans for New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what a great name for that group, and they're basically a super PAC that is out there campaigning against one of three people in that county commission race because he is anti Santa Lena development. I think it's ironic that New Mexico got a lot of their money from a developer in Phoenix.
Sandra, are you by a dump truck somewhere?
No, I'm not.
Okay, that must be another line.
It sounded
I apologize.
Like the Santa Lena developers.
an actual landline.
Ah, but, there you go.
You know, state law, you can take unlimited developments. Now, Bernalillo County has...
You can take unlimited contributions?
Donations. And, you know, Bernalillo County does have some regulations about people doing business with the county donating to candidates, but it doesn't appear that, you know, it's questionable whether those laws appear to political action committees. And one county commissioner has filed a complaint about this New Mexicans for New Mexico PAC and their activities, saying that they've violated those donation limits for somebody doing business with the county. But there really aren't, you know, there just really aren't, especially after things like Citizen United and McCutcheon and all these other Supreme Court decisions, there are not a lot of limits or ways to limit who gives money and how much they give to something like a political action committee that, you know, one of the requirements is that they not coordinate with candidates. And, you know, one of the candidates that they're supporting has said that he doesn't actually necessarily want their support. That's one of the problems with some of these PACs. Sometimes they send out information or put out ads that the candidate would really not prefer to be affiliated with, and there's nothing they can do as a candidate to stop them.
Well, as we wind up the show, this is an interesting point, Lana, because there's been a huge dissatisfaction with this kind of money nationwide. Is that are we seeing this huge shift right now in terms of people jumping party lines to vote for certain candidates?
I think people at a sort of gut level understand that there's a lot of money in politics and that we've moved away from prioritizing voter interests to candidates and elected officials at least appear to be polarized in part because they're focused on moneyed interests, not on voter interests. Voters are much more moderate. And, you know, ideologues are much more out in the extremes and they give all the money. And that's where the problem is. There is part this is providing or promoting polarization in our government.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we will be talking more as we get towards Election Day about elections. I want to thank my guests for joining us on the KUNM call-in show today. Gabriel Sanchez, the University of New Mexico and Latino Decisions. Lana Atkison, professor and director of the Center for Voting Elections and Democracy at UNM. Steve Terrell with the Santa Fe New Mexican and Sandra Fish with New Mexico In Depth. Thank you all. Thank you to our callers and those who sent emails and tweets. If you missed any of our program or if you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted to our website, kunm.org, where you can also find previous call-in shows. We've also posted links to the articles and polls we talked about today and about the primary and the national and statewide races. Next Thursday morning on the KUNM Call-In Show, we'll look at how the University of New Mexico handles sexual assault and harassment complaints, and we'll review criticism by the U.S. Department of Justice. That's next Thursday morning at 8 here on 89.9 KUNM. Thanks to Jefferson White, who engineered the show. Anna Landy live tweeted today. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Ed Williams produced our show today. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is KUNM. Thank you for listening.